Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Chapter 8 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 8. The Gift Horse.
Your dog is your own dog, remarked Jerry Strann, still to the back of the card-laying stranger. But he ain't your backyard. Keep your eye on him, or I'll fix him so he won't need watching.
So saying, he made another step forward, and it brought a snarl from the dog. Not one of those high whining noises, but a deep guttural that sounded like indrawn breath. The gun of Jerry Strann leaped into his hand.
Bart, said the gentle-voiced stranger, lie down and don't talk.
And he turned in his chair, pulled his hat straight, and looked mildly upon the gunman. An artist would have made much of that picture. For there was in this man, as in Strann, a singular portion of beauty. It was not, however, free from objection, for he had not the open manliness of the larger of the two. Indeed, a feminine grace and softness marked him. His wrists were as round as a girl's, and his hands as slender and as delicately finished. Whether it be the white-hot sun of summer or the hurricane snows of winter, the climate of the mountain desert roughens the skin, and it cuts away spare flesh, hewing out the face in angles. But with this man there were no rough edges, but all was smoothed over and rounded with painful care, as if nature had concentrated in that birth to show what she could do. Such fine workmanship, perhaps, would be appreciated more by women than by men, for men like a certain weight and bulk of bone and muscle, whereas this fellow seemed as light of body as he was of hand. He sat now watching Strann with the utmost gravity. He had very large brown eyes of a puzzling quality. Perhaps that was because there seemed to be no thought behind them, and one eye caught the mystery and the wistfulness of some animals from a glance at him. The effect of that glance on Strann was to make him grin again, and he at once banished the frown from his forehead and put away his gun. The big dog had slunk deeper into the shadow and closer to his master.
I'm Strann. Maybe you've heard of me.
My name is Barry, said the other. I'm sorry that I haven't heard of you before. And the sound of his voice made Jerry Strann grin again. It was such a low, soft voice, with the velvet of a young girl's tone in it. Moreover, the brown eyes seemed to apologize for the ignorance concerning Strand's name.
You got a hoss out front.
A nod of agreement.
What's your price?
None.
No price? Look here, argued Strann. Everything's got a price, and I got to have that hoss, understand? Got to. I ain't bargaining. I won't try to beat you down. You just set a figure, and I'll cover it. I guess that's square.
He ain't a gentle horse, said Barry. Maybe you wouldn't like him.
Oh, that's all right about being gentle, chuckled Strann. Then he checked his mirth and stared piercingly at the other to make out if there were a secret mockery. It could not, however, be possible. The eyes were as gravely apologetic as ever. He continued, I seen the hell fire in 'em. That's what stopped me like a bullet. I like 'em that way. Much rather have him with a fight. Well, let's have your price. Hey, O'Brien, trot out your red eye. I'm going to do some business here. O'Brien came hastily with drinks, and while they waited, Strann queried politely. Belong around these parts?
No, answered the other softly.
No? Where you come from?
Over there, said Barry, and waved a graceful hand toward half the points of the compass.
"'Hm,' muttered Strann, and once more he bent a keen gaze upon his companion. The drinks were now placed before them. "Here," he concluded, "is that black devil outside," and he swallowed the liquor at a gulp. But as he replaced the empty glass on the table, he observed with breathless amazement that the whiskey glass of the stranger was still full. He had drunk his chaser. "Now, by God," said Strann in a ringing voice, and struck a heavy hand upon the top of the table. He regained his control, however, instantly. "Now, about that price." "I don't know what horses are worth," replied Barry. "To start, then, $500 in cold cash, gold, for you. What's his name?"
"Satan."
"Eh?"
"Satan."
Murmured Strand again. "$500 for Satan, then. How about it?"
"If you can ride him," began the stranger.
"Oh, hell," smiled Strand with a large and careless gesture. "I'll ride him, all right."
"Then I would let you take him for nothing," concluded Barry.
"You'd what?" said Strand. Then he rose slowly from his chair and shouted. Instantly the swinging doors broke open and a throng of faces appeared at the gap. "Boys, this gent here is going to give me that black, if I can ride him." He turned back on Barry. "They've heard it," he concluded, "and this bargain is going to stick just this way. If your hoss can throw me, the deal's off, eh?"
"Oh, yes," nodded the brown-eyed man.
"What's the idea?" asked one of Jerry's followers, as the latter stepped through the doors of the saloon onto the street.
"I don't know," said Jerry. "That gent looks kind of simple. But it ain't my fault if he made a rotten bargain. Here, you."
And he seized the bridle reins of the black stallion. Speed, lightning speed, was what saved him. For the instant his fingers touched the leather, Satan twisted his head and snapped like an angry dog. The teeth clicked beside Strand's shoulder as he leaped back. He laughed savagely.
"That'll be took out of him," he announced, "and damned quick."
Here the voice of Barry was heard saying, "I'll help you mount, Mr. Strand." And he edged his way through the little crowd until he stood at the head of the stallion.
"Look out," warned Strand in real alarm, "or he'll take your head off."
But Barry was already beside his horse, and with his back toward those vicious teeth, he drew the reins over his head. As for the stallion, it pricked one ear forward and then the other, and muzzled the man's shoulder confidingly. There was a liberal chorus of astonished oaths from the gathering.
"I'll hold his head while you get on," suggested Barry, turning his mild eyes upon Strand again.
"Well," muttered the big man, "may I be eternally damned." He added, "All right, hold his head. I'll ride him without pulling leather. Is that square?"
Barry nodded absently. His slender fingers were patting the velvet nose of the stallion, and he was talking to it in an affectionate undertone, meaningless words, perhaps, such as a mother uses to soothe a child. When Strand set his foot in the stirrup and gathered up the reins, the black horse cringed and shuddered. It was not a pleasant thing to see. It was like a dog crouching under the suspended whip. It was worse than that. It was almost the horror of a man who shivers at the touch of an unclean animal. There was not a sound from the crowd, and every grin was wiped out. Jerry Strand swung into the saddle lightly. There he sat, testing the stirrups. They were too short by inches, but he refused to have them lengthened. He poised his quirt and tugged his hat lower over his eyes.
"Turn him loose," he shouted. "Hey!"
And his shrill yell went down the street, and the echoes sent it barking back from wall to wall. Barry stepped back from the head of the black, but for an instant the horse did not stir. He was trembling violently, but his blazing eyes were fixed upon the face of his owner. Barry raised his hand. And then it happened. It was like the release of a coiled watch spring. The black whirled as a top spins, and Strand sagged far to the left. Before he could recover, the stallion was away in a flash, like a racer leaving the barrier and reaching full speed in almost a stride. Not far, hardly the breadth of the street, before he pitched up in a long leap as if to clear a barrier, landed stiff-legged with a sickening jar, whirled again like a spinning top, and darted straight back. And Jerry Strann pulled leather, with might and main, but the short stirrups were against him, and above all, the suddenness of the start had taken him off guard for all his readiness. When the stallion dropped stiff-legged, Jerry was thrown forward, and an unlucky left foot jarred loose from the stirrup, and when the horse whirled, Strann was flung from the saddle. It was a clean fall. He twisted over in the air as he fell, and landed in deep dust. The black stallion had reached his master, and now he turned in that same cat-like manner, and watched with prickling ears as Strann dragged himself up from the dust. There was no shout of laughter, no cheer for that fall, and without a smile they watched Strann returning. Big O'Brien had seen from his open door, and now he laid a hand on the shoulder of one of the men and whispered at his ear, "There's going to be trouble, bad trouble. Billy, go for Fatty Matthews. He's a deputy marshal now, and get him here as quick as you can. Run." The others spared time for a last glance at Strann, and then hurried down the street. Now, a man who can lose and smile is generally considered the most graceful of failures. But the smile of Jerry Strann as he walked slowly back worried his followers. "We all hit dust sometime," he philosophized. "But one try don't prove nothing. I ain't near through with that hoss." Barry turned to Strann. If there had been mockery in his eyes or a smile on his lips as he faced Jerry, there would have been a gunplay on the spot. But instead, the brown eyes were as dumbly apologetic as ever. "We didn't talk about two tries," he observed. "We'll talk about it now," said Strann. There was one man in the crowd a little too old to be dangerous, and therefore there was one man who was in a position to speak openly to Strann. It was Big O'Brien. "Jerry, you named your game and you made your play and lost. I guess you ain't going to turn up a hard loser. Nobody plays twice for the same pot." The hazel eyes of Strann were gray with anguish of the spirit as he looked from O'Brien to the crowd, and from the crowd to Satan, and from Satan to his meek-eyed owner. Nowhere was there a defiant eye or a glint of scorn on which he could wreak his wrath. He stood poised in his anger for the space of a breath. Then, in the sharp struggle, his better nature conquered. "Come on in, all of you," he called. "We'll liquor and forget this." End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 9. Battle Light. O'Brien pressed close to Barry. "Partner," he said rapidly, "you're clear now. You're clear of more hell than you ever dreamed. Now, climb that hoss of yours and feed him leather till you get clear of Brownsville. And if I was you, I'd never come within a day's ride of the Three B's again." The mild brown eyes widened. "I don't like crowds," murmured Barry. "You're wise, kid," grinned the bartender. "A hell of a lot wiser than you know right now. On your way." And he turned to follow the crowd into the saloon. But Jerry Strann stood at the swinging doors watching, and he saw Barry linger behind. "Are you coming?" he called. "I got an engagement," answered the meek voice. "You got another engagement here," mocked Strann. "Understand?" The other hesitated for an instant, and then sighed deeply. "I suppose I'll stay," he murmured, and walked into the bar. Jerry Strann was smiling in the way that showed his teeth. As Barry passed, he said softly, "I see we ain't going to have no trouble, you and me." And he moved to clap his strong hand on the shoulder of the smaller man. Oddly enough, the hand missed, for Barry swerved from beneath it as a wolf swerves from the shadow of a falling branch. No perceptible effort, no sudden start of tensed muscles, but a movement so smooth that it was almost unnoticeable. But the hand of Strann fell through thin air.
"You're quick," he said, "if you is as quick with your hands as you are with your feet."
Barry paused, and the melancholy brown eyes dwelt on the face of Strand.
"Oh, hell," snorted the other, and turned on his heel to the bar. "Drink up," he commanded. A shout and a snarl from the further end of the room.
"A wolf, by God," yelled one of the men.
The owner of the animal made his way with unobtrusive swiftness the length of the room and stood between the dog and a man who fingered the butt of his gun nervously.
"He won't hurt you none," murmured that softly assuring voice.
"Hell, he won't," responded the other. "He took a pass at my leg just now and damn near took it off. Got teeth like the blades of a pocket knife."
"You're on a cold trail, Sam," broke in one of the others.
"That ain't any wolf. Look at him now."
The big, shaggy animal had slunk to the feet of his master, and, with head abased, stared furtively up into Barry's face. A gesture served as sufficient command, and he slipped shadow-like into the corner and crouched with his head on his paws, and the incandescent green of his eyes glimmering. Barry sat down in a chair nearby. O'Brien was happily spinning bottles and glasses the length of the bar. There was a chiming of glass and the rumble of contented voices.
"Red eye all around," said the loud voice of Jerry Strand. "But there's one out."
"Who's out?"
"Oh, it's him. Hey, O'Brien, lemonade for the lady."
It brought a laugh, a deep, good-natured laugh, and then a chorus of mockery. But Barry stepped unconfused to the bar, accepted the glass of lemonade, and when the others downed their fire water, he sipped his drink thoughtfully. Outside, the wind had risen, and it shook the hotel and carried a score of faint voices as it whirled round the corners and through cracks. Perhaps it was one of those voices which made the big dog lift its head from its paws and whine softly. Surely it was something he heard which caused Barry to straighten at the bar and cant his head slightly to one side. But, as certainly, no one else in the barroom heard it. Barry set down his glass. "Mr. Strand," he called, and the gentle voice carried faintly down through the uproar of the bar.
"Sister wants to speak to you," suggested O'Brien to Strand.
"Well," roared the latter, "what do you want?"
The others were silent to listen, and they smiled in anticipation.
"If you don't mind much," said the musical voice, "I think I'll be moving along.
There is an obscure little devil living in all of us. It makes the child break his own toys. It makes the husband strike the helpless wife. It makes the man beat the cringing, whining dog. The greatest of American writers has called it the imp of the perverse. And that devil came in Jerry Strand and made his heart small and cold. If he had been by nature the bully and the ruffian, there would have been no point in all that followed. But the heart of Jerry Strand was ordinarily as warm as the yellow sunshine itself. And it was a common saying in the Three B's that Jerry Strand would take from a child what he would not endure from a mountain lion. Women loved Jerry Strand, and children would crowd about his knees, but this day the small demon was in him.
"You want to be moving along?" mimicked the devil in Jerry Strand.
"Well, you wait a while. I ain't through with you yet."
"Maybe."
He paused and searched his mind.
"You've given me a fall, and maybe you can give the rest of us a laugh."
The chuckle of appreciation went up the bar and down it again.
"I want to ask you," went on the devil in Jerry Strand, "where you got your horse?"
"He was running wild," came the gentle answer. "So I took a walk one day and brought him in." A pause.
"Maybe," grinned the big man, "you creased him?"
For it is one of the most difficult things in the world to capture a wild horse, and some hunters, in their desperation at seeing the wonderful animals escape, have tried to crease them. That is, they strive to shoot so that the bullet will barely graze the top of the animal's vertebrae, just behind the ears, stunning the horse and making it helpless for capture. But necessarily, such shots are made from a distance, and little short of a miracle is needed to make the bullet strike true. For a fraction of an inch too low means death. So another laugh of appreciation ran around the barroom at the mention of creasing. "No," answered Barry. "I went out with a halter, and after a while Satan got used to me and followed me home. They waited only long enough to draw a deep breath. Then came a long yell of delight. But the obscure devil was growing stronger and stronger in Stran. He beat on the bar until he got silence. Then he leaned over to meet the eyes of Barry. "That," he remarked through his teeth, "is a damned lie. There's only one way of answering that word in the mountain desert," and Barry did not take it. The melancholy brown eyes widened. He sighed, and raising his glass of lemonade, sipped it slowly. Came a sick silence in the barroom. Men turned their eyes toward each other, and then flashed them away again. It is not good that one who has the eyes and the tongue of a man should take water from another, even from Jerry Strann. And even Jerry Strann withdrew his eyes slowly from his prey and shuddered. The sight of the most grisly death is not so horrible as cowardness. And the devil, which was still strong in Strann, made him look about for a new target. Barry was removed from all danger by an incredible barrier. He found that new target at once, for his glance reached to the corner of the room and found there the greenish, glimmering eyes of the dog. He smote upon the bar. "Is this a damned kennel?" he shouted. "Do I got a drink in a barnyard? What's that dog doing here?" And he caught up the heavy little whiskey glass and hurled it at the crouching dog. It thudded heavily, but it brought no yelp of pain. Instead, a black thunderbolt leaped from the corner and lunged down the room. It was the silence of the attack that made it terrible, and Strann cursed and pulled his gun. He could never have used it. He was a whole half second too late. But before the dog sprang, a voice cut in. "Bart!" It checked the animal in its very leap. It landed on the floor and slid on stiffly extended legs to the feet of Strann. "Bart!" rang the voice again, and the beast, flattening to the floor, crawled backwards inch by inch. It was slavering, and there was a raving madness in its eyes. "Look at it!" cried Strann. "By God, it's mad!" And he raised his gun to draw the bead. "Wait!" called the same voice which had checked the spring of the dog. Surely it could not have come from the lips of Barry. It held a resonance of chiming metal. It was not loud, but it carried like a brazen bell. "Don't do it, Strann." And it came to every man in the barroom that it was unhealthy to stand between the two men at that instant. A sudden path opened from Barry to Strann. "Bart!" came the command again. "Heel!" The dog obeyed with slinking swiftness. Jerry Strann put up his gun and smiled. "I don't take a start on no man," he announced quite pleasantly. "I don't need to. But, you yellow-hearted hound, get out from between. When I make my draw, I'm going to kill that damned wolf." Now, the fighting face of Jerry Strann was well known in the Three B's, and it was something for men to remember until they died in a peaceful bed. Yet there was not a glance from the bystanders for Strann. They stood back against the wall, flattening themselves, and they stared fascinated at the slender stranger. Not that his face had grown ugly by a sudden metamorphosis. It was more beautiful than ever, for the man was smiling. It was his eyes which held them. Behind the brown, a light was growing, a yellow, an unearthly glimmer, which one felt might be seen on the darkest night. There was none of the coward in Jerry Strann. He looked full into that yellow, glimmering, changing light. He looked steadily, and a strange feeling swept over him. No, it was not fear. Long experience had taught him that there was not another man in the Three B's, with the exception of his own terrible brother, who could get a gun out of the leather faster than he. But now it seemed to Jerry Strann that he was facing something more than mortal speed and human strength and surety. He could not tell in what the feeling was based, but it was a giant, dim foreboding, holding dominion over other men's lives, and it sent a train of chilly weakness through his blood. "It's a habit of mine," said Jerry Strann, "to kill mad dogs when I see 'em." And he smiled again. They stood for another long instant, facing each other. It was plain that every muscle in Strand's body was growing tense. The very smile was frozen on his lips. When he moved, at last, It was a convulsive jerk of his arm, and it was said afterward that his gun was all clear of the leather before the calm stranger stirred. No eye followed what happened. Can the eye follow such speed as the cracking lash of a whip? There was only one report. The forefinger of Strann did not touch his trigger, but the gun slipped down and dangled loosely from his hand. He made a pace forward, with his smile grown to an idiotic thing, and a patch of red sprang out in the center of his breast. Then he lurched headlong to the floor. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 10. Sweet Adeline. Fatty Matthews came panting through the doors. He was one of those men who have a leisurely build and a purely American desire for action, so that he was always hurrying and always puffing. If he mounted a horse, sweat started out from every pore. If he swallowed a glass of red-eye, he breathed hard thereafter. Yet he was capable of great and sustained exertions, as many and many a man in the Three B's could testify. He was ashamed of his fat. Imagine the soul of a bald eagle in the body of a Poland China sow, and you begin to have some idea of Fatty Matthews. Fat filled his boots as with water, and he made a squinching sound when he walked. Fat rolled along his jowls. Fat made his very forehead flabby. Fat almost buried his eyes. But nothing could conceal the hawk line of his nose or the gleam of those half-buried eyes. His hair was short-cropped, gray, and stood on end like bristles, and he was in the habit of using his panting breath in humming, for that concealed the puffing. So Fatty Matthews came through the doors, and his little concealed eyes darted from face to face. Then he kneeled beside Strann. He was humming as he opened Jerry's shirt. He was humming as he pulled from his bag, for Fatty was almost as much a doctor as he was marshal, cowpuncher, miner, and gambler, a roll of cotton and another roll of bandages. The crowd grouped around him fascinated, and at his directions some of them brought water and others raised and turned the body while the marshal made the bandages. Jerry Strann was unconscious. Fatty Matthews began to intersperse talk in his humming. "You was plugged from in front, my beauty, was you?" grunted Fatty. And then, running the roll of bandage around the wounded man's chest, he hummed a bar of, "Sweet Adeline, my Adeline, at night, dear heart, for you I pine." "Was Jerry looking the other way when he was spotted?" asked Fatty of the bystanders. "O'Brien, you seen it?" O'Brien cleared his throat. "I didn't see nothing," he said mildly, and began to mop his bar, which was already polished beyond belief. "Well," muttered Fatty Matthews, "all these birds get it, and Jerry was some overdue. Lou, you seen it?" "Yep." "Some drunken bum do it?" Lou leaned to the ear of the kneeling marshal and whispered briefly. Fatty opened his eyes and cursed until his panting forced him to break off and hum. "Beat him to the draw?" he gasped at length. "Jerry's gun was clean out before the stranger made a move," asserted Lou. "It ain't possible," murmured the deputy, and hummed softly. "In all my dreams, your fair face beams." He added sharply as he finished the bandaging, "Where'd he head for?" "No place," answered Lou. "He just now went out the door." The deputy swore again, but he added, enlightened, "Going to plead self-defense, eh?" Big O'Brien leaned over the bar. "Listen, Fatty," he said earnestly, "there ain't no doubt of it. Jerry had his war paint on. He tried to kill this fella Barry's wolf." "Wolf?" cut in the deputy marshal. "Dog, I guess," qualified the bartender. "I dunno. Anyway, Jerry made all the leads. This Barry simply done to finish him. I say, don't put this Barry under arrest. You want to keep him here for Max Strann."
"That's my business," growled Fatty. "Hey, half a dozen of you gents, hook on to Jerry and take him up to a room. I'll be with you in a minute." And while his directions were being obeyed, he trotted heavily up the length of the barroom and out the swinging doors. Outside, he found only one man and in the act of mounting a black horse. The deputy marshal made straight for that man until a huge black dog appeared from nowhere, blocking his path. It was a silent dog, but its teeth and eyes set enough to stop Fatty in full career. "Are you Barry?" he asked. "That's me. Come here, Bart." The big dog backed to the other side of the horse without shifting his eyes from the marshal. The latter gingerly approached the rider, who sat perfectly at ease in the saddle. Most apparently, he was in no haste to leave. "Barry," said the deputy, "don't make no play when I tell you who I am. I don't mean you no harm, but my name's Matthews, and..." He drew back the flap of his vest enough to show the glitter of his badge of office. All the time, his little beady eyes watched Barry with bird-like intentness. The rider made not a move. And now Matthews noted more in detail the feminine slenderness of the man and the large, placid eyes. He stepped closer and dropped a confidential hand on the pommel of the saddle. "Son," he muttered, "I hear you made a clean play inside. Now, I know Strand in his way. He was in wrong. There ain't a doubt of it. And if I held you, you'd get clear on self-defense. So I ain't going to lay a hand on you. You're free. But one thing more. You cut off there, see? And bear away north from the three B's. You got a hoss, that is. And believe me, you'll need him before you're through." He lowered his voice, and his eyes bulged with the terror of his tidings. "Feed him the leather. Ride to beat hell. Never stop while your hoss can raise a trot. And then slide off your hoss and get another. Son, in 3 days, Mac Strann will be on your trail." He stepped back and waved his arms. "Now, vamonos." The black stallion flicked back its ears and winced from the outflung hands. But the rider remained imperturbed. "I never heard of Mac Strann," said Barry.
"You never heard of Mac Strann?" echoed the other.
"But I'd like to meet him," said Barry. The deputy marshal blinked his eyes rapidly, as though he needed to clear his vision.
"Son," he said hoarsely, "I can see your game, but don't make a foul play. If Mac Strann gets you, he'll California like a yearling. You won't have no chance. You've done for Jerry, there ain't a doubt of that. But Jerry to Mac is like a tame cat to a mountain lion, lad. I can see you're a stranger to these parts. But ask me your questions, and I'll tell you the best way to go." Barry slipped from the saddle. He said, "I'd like to know the best place to put up my hoss." The deputy marshal was speechless. "But I suppose," went on Barry, "I can stable him over there behind the hotel." Matthews pushed off his sombrero and rubbed his short fingers through his hair. Anger and amazement still choked him, but he controlled himself by a praiseworthy effort. "Barry," he said, "I don't make you out. Maybe you figure to wait till Mac Strann gets to town before you leave. Maybe you think your horse can outrun anything on 4 feet, and maybe it can. But listen to me. Mac Strann ain't fast on a trail, but the point about him is that he never leaves it. You can go through rain and over rocks, but you can't never shake Mac Strann, not once he gets the wind of you."
"Thanks," returned the gentle-voiced stranger. "I guess maybe he'll be worth meeting." And so saying, he turned on his heel and walked calmly towards the big stables behind the hotel, and at his heels followed the black dog and the black horse. As for Deputy Marshal Matthews, he moistened his lips to whistle. But when he pursed them, not a sound came. He turned at length into the barroom, and as he walked, his eye was vacant. He was humming brokenly. "Sweet Adeline, my Adeline, at night, dear heart, for you I pine." Inside, he took firm hold upon the bar with both pudgy hands. "Brian," he said, "Red Eye." He pushed away the small glass which the bartender spun towards him and seized in its place a mighty water tumbler. "O'Brien," he explained, "I need strength.
not encouragement. And filling the glass nearly to the brim, he downed the huge potion with a single draught. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 11. The Buzzard. Most animals have their human counterparts, and in that room where Jerry Strann had fallen, a whimsical observer might have termed Jerry, with his tawny head, the lion, and O'Brien behind the bar, a shaggy bear, and the deputy marshal, a wolverine, fat but dangerous. And here stood a man as ugly and hardened as a desert cayuse, and there was Dan Barry, sleek and supple as a panther. But among the rest, this whimsical observer must have noticed a fellow of prodigious height and negligible breadth, a structure of sinews and bones that promised a rattle in the wind, a long, narrow head, a nose like a beak, tiny eyes set close together and shining like polished buttons, and a vast Adam's apple that rolled up and down the scraggy throat. He might have done for the spirit of famine in an old play, but every dweller of the mountain desert would have found an apter expression by calling him the buzzard of the scene. Through his prodigious ugliness, he was known far and wide as Haw Haw Langley, for on occasion Langley laughed, and his laughter was an indescribable sound that lay somewhere between the braying of a mule and the cawing of a crow. But Haw Haw Langley was usually silent, and he would sit for hours without words, twisting his head and making little pecking motions as his eyes fastened on face after face. All the bitterness of the mountain desert was in Haw Haw Langley. If his body looked like a buzzard, his soul was the soul of the vulture itself. And therefore he had followed the courses of Jerry Strann up and down the range. He stuffed his gorge with the fragments of his leader's food. He fed his soul with the dangers which Jerry Strann met and conquered. In the bar room, Haw Haw Langley had stood turning his sharp little eyes from Jerry Strann to Dan Barry, and from Dan Barry back to Strann. And when the shot was fired, something like a grin twisted his thin lips. And when the spot of red glowed on the breast of the staggering man, the eyes of Haw Haw blazed as if with a reflection of a devouring fire. Afterwards, he lingered for a few minutes, making no effort to aid the fallen man. But when he had satisfied himself with the extent of the injury, and when he had noted the froth of bloody bubbles which stained the lips of Strann, Haw Haw Langley turned and stalked from the room. His eyes were points of light, and his soul was crammed to repletion with ill tidings. At the hitching rack, he stepped into the saddle of a diminutive horse, whirled it into the street with a staggering jerk of the reins, and buried the spurs deep in the cowpony's flanks. The poor brute snorted and flirted its heels in the air, but Langley wrapped his long legs around the barrel of his mount and goaded it again. His smile, which began with the crack of Barry's gun in O'Brien's place, did not die out until he was many a mile away, headed far up through the mountains. But as he put peak after peak behind him, and as the white light of the day diminished and puffs of blue shadow drowned the valleys, the grin disappeared from Haw Haw's face. He became keenly intent on his course until, having reached the very summit of a tall hill, he came to a halt and peered down before him. It was nearly dusk by this time, and the eyes of an ordinary man could not distinguish a tree from a rock at any great distance. But it seemed that Haw Haw was gifted with eyes extraordinary. The buzzard at the top of its sky-towering circles does not see the brown carcass far below with more certainty than Haw Haw sensed his direction. He waited only a few seconds before he rolled the rowels once more along the scored flanks of his mustang, and then plunged down the slope at a reckless gallop. His destination was a hut, or rather a lean-to, that pressed against the side of the mountain, a crazy structure with a single length of stovepipe leaning awry from the roof. And at the door of this house, Haw Haw Langley drew rein and stepped to the ground. The interior of the hut was dark, but Haw Haw stole with the caution of a wild Indian to the entrance and reconnoitered the interior, probing every shadowy corner with his glittering eyes. For several long moments he continued this examination, and even when he was satisfied that there was no one in the place, he did not enter, but moved back several paces from the door and swept the sides of the mountains with an uneasy eye. He made out, a short distance from the door, a picketed horse, which now reared up its head from the miserable scattering of grass on which it fed, and stared at the stranger. The animal must have bulked at least twice as large as the mount which had brought Langley to the mountainside, and it was muscled even out of proportion to its bulk. The head was so tremendously broad that it gave an almost square appearance, the neck short and thick, the forelegs disproportionately small but very sturdy, and the whole animal was built on a slope towards the hindquarters, which seemed to equal in massiveness all the rest of the body. One would have said that the horse was a freak meant by nature for the climbing of hills, and to glance at it, no man could suppose that those ponderous limbs might be moved to a gallop. However, Haw Haw Langley well knew the powers of the ugly beast, and he even made a detour and walked about the horse to view it more closely. Now he again surveyed the darkening landscape, and then turned once more to the house. This time he entered with the boldness of a possessor, approaching his hearth. He lighted a match, and with this ignited a lantern hanging from the wall to the right of the door. The furnishings of the dwelling were primitive beyond compare. There was no sign of a chair. A huddle of blankets on the bare boards of the floor made the bed. A saddle hung by one stirrup on one side, and on the other side leaned the skins of bobcats, lynx, and coyotes on their stretching and drying boards. Haw Haw took down the lantern and examined the pelts. The animals had been skinned with the utmost dexterity. As far as he could see, the hides had not been marred in a single place by slips of the knife, nor were there any bloodstains to attest hurried work, or careless shooting in the first place. The inner surfaces shone with the pure white of old parchment. But Haw Haw gave his chief attention to the legs and the heads of the skins, for these were the places where carelessness or stupidity with the knife were sure to show. But the work was perfect in every respect, until even the critical Haw Haw Langley was forced to step back and shake his head in admiration. He continued his survey of the room. In one corner stood a rifle and a shotgun. In another was a pile of provisions, bacon, flour, salt, meal, and little else. Spices and condiments were apparently unknown to this hermit, nor was there even the inevitable coffee, nor any of the molasses or other sweets which the tongue of the desert mountaineer cannot resist. Flour, meat, and water, it seemed, made up the entire fare of the trapper. For cookery, there was an unboarded space in the very center of the floor, with a number of rocks grouped around in the hole and blackened with soot. The smoke must rise, therefore, and escape through the small hole in the center of the roof. The length of stovepipe which showed on the roof must have been simply the inhabitant's idea of giving the last delicate touch of civilization. It was like a tassel to the cap of the Turk. As Haw Haw's observations reached this point, his sharp ear caught the faint whinny of the big horse outside. He started like one caught in a guilty act and sprang to the lantern. However, with his hands upon it, he thought better of it, and he placed the light against the wall. Then he turned to the entrance and looked anxiously up the hillside. What he saw was a form grotesque beyond belief. It seemed to be some gigantic wild beast, mountain lion, or great bear, though of a size beyond precedence, which slowly sprawled down the slope, walking erect upon its hind feet, with its forelegs stretched out horizontal, as if it were warning all who might behold it away. Haw Haw grew pale and involuntarily reached for his gun as he first beheld this apparition. But instantly he saw the truth. It was a man who carried a burden down the mountainside. The burden was the carcass of a bear. The man had drawn the forelegs over his shoulders, his jutting elbows making what had seemed the outstretched arms. And above the head of the burden-bearer rose the great head of the bear. As the man came closer, the animal's head flopped to one side, and a red tongue lolled from its mouth. Haw Haw Langley moved back step by step through the cabin until his shoulders struck the opposite wall, and at the same time Mac Strann entered the room. He had no ear for his visitor's hail, but cast his burden to the floor. It dropped with a shock that shook the house from the rattling stovepipe to the crackling boards. For a moment Mac Strann regarded his prey. Then he stooped and drew open the great jaws. The mouth within was not so red as the bloody hands of Mac Strann, and the big white fangs, for some reason, did not seem terrible in comparison with the hunter. Having completed his survey, he turned slowly upon Haw Haw Langley and lowered his eyebrows to stare. So doing, the light for the first time struck full upon his face. Haw Haw Langley bit his thin lips, and his eyes widened almost to the normal. For the ugliness of Mac Strann was the most terrible species of ugliness. Not disfigured features, but a discord which pervaded the man and came from within him like a sound. Feature by feature, his face was not ugly. The mouth was very large, to be sure, and the jaw too heavily square, and the nose needed somewhat greater length and less width for real comeliness. The eyes were truly fine, being very large and black, though when Mac Strann lowered his bush of brows, his eyes were practically reduced to gleams of light in the consequent shadow. There was a sharp angle in his forehead, the lines of it meeting in the center and shelving up and down. One felt, unpleasantly, that there were heavy muscles overlaying that forehead. One felt that to touch it would be a pad of flesh, and it gave to Mac Strann, more than any other feature, a peculiar impression of resistless physical power. In the catalogue of his features, indeed, there was nothing severely objectionable, but out of it came a feeling of too much strength. A glance at his body reinsured the first thought. It was not normal. His shirt bulged tightly at the shoulders with muscles. He was not tall, inches shorter than his brother Jerry, for instance, but the bulk of his body was incredible. His torso was a veritable barrel that bulged out both in the chest and the back. And even the tremendous thighs of Mac Strann were perceptibly bowed out by the weight which they had to carry. And there was about his management of his arms a peculiar awkwardness which only the very strongest of men exhibit, as if they were burdened by the weight of their mere dangling hands. This giant, having placed his eyes in shadow, peered for a long moment at Haw Haw Langley, but very soon his glance began to waver. It flashed towards the wall. It came back and rested upon Langley again. He was like a dog, restless under a steady stare, and as Haw Haw Langley noted this, a glitter of joy came into his beady eyes. "You're Jerry's man," said Mac Strann at length. There was about his voice the same fleshy quality that was in his face. It came literally from his stomach, and it made a peculiar rustling sound, such as comes after one has eaten sticky, sweet things. People could listen to the voice of Mac Strann and forget that he was speaking words. The articulation ran together in a sort of glutinous mass. "I'm a friend of Jerry," said the other. "I'm Langley." The big man stretched out his hand. The hair grew black down to the knuckles. The blood of the bear still streaked it. It was large enough to be an organism with independent life. But when Langley, with some misgiving, trusted his own bony fingers within that grasp, it was only as if something fleshy, soft, and bloodless had closed over them. When his hand was released, he rubbed it covertly against his trouser leg. To remove dirt, restore the circulation, he did not know why. "Who's bothering Jerry?" asked Mac Strann. "And where is he?" He went to the wall without waiting for an answer and took down the saddle. Now, the cowpuncher's saddle is a heavy mass of leather and steel, and the saddle of Mac Strann was far larger than the ordinary. Yet, he took down the saddle as one might remove a card from a rack. Haw Haw Langley moved towards the door to give himself a free space for exit.
"Jerry's hurt," he said, and he watched.
There was a ripple of pain on the face of Mac Strann.
"Hoss kicked him? Fall on him?" he asked.
"It weren't a horse."
"Huh? A cow?"
"Weren't no cow. It weren't no animal."
Mac Strann faced full upon Langley. When he spoke, it seemed as if it were difficult for him to manage his lips. They lifted an appreciable space before there was any sound.
"What was it?"
"A man."
Langley edged back towards the door.
"With what?"
"A gun."
And Langley saw the danger that was coming even before Mac Strann moved. He gave a shrill yelp of terror and whirled and sprang for the open. But Mac Strann sprang after him and reached. His whole body seemed to stretch like an elastic thing, and his arm grew longer. The hand fastened on the back of Langley, plucked him up and jammed him against the wall. Haw Haw crumpled to the floor. He gasped.
"It weren't me, Mac. For God's sakes, it weren't me."
His face was a study. There was abject terror in it, and yet there was also a sort of grisly joy, and his eyes feasted on the silent agony of Mac Strann.
"Where?" asked Mac Strann.
"Mac," pleaded the vulture, who cringed on the floor.
"Gimme your word you ain't going to hold it against me."
"Tell me," said the other, and he framed the face of the vulture between his large hands. If he pressed the heels of those hands together, bones would snap, and Haw Haw Langley knew it. And yet nothing but a wild delight could have set that glitter in his little eyes, just as nothing but a palsy of terror could have set his limbs twitching so.
"Who shot him from behind?" demanded the giant.
"It wasn't from behind," croaked the bearer of ill tidings.
"It was from the front."
"While he wasn't looking?"
"No, he was beat to the draw."
"You're lying to me," said Mac Strann slowly.
"So help me God," cried Langley.
"Who done it?"
"The little feller. He ain't half as big as me. He's got a voice like Kitty Jackson, the schoolmarm, and he's got eyes like a starved pup. It was him that done it."
The eyes of Mac Strann grew vaguely meditative. "Nope," he mused in an answer to his own thoughts.
"I won't use no rope. I'll use my hands."
"Where'd the bullet land?"
A fresh agony of trembling shook Langley, and a fresh sparkle came in his glance.
"Betwixt his ribs, Mac, and right on through, and it come out his back."
But there was not an answering tremor in Mac Strann. He let his hands fall away from the face of the vulture, and he caught up the saddle. Langley straightened himself. He peered anxiously at Strann, as if he feared to miss something.
"I don't know whether he's living right now or not," suggested Haw Haw.
But Mac Strann was already striding through the door. Sweat was pouring from the lather-flecked bodies of their horses when they drew rein at last at the goal of their long, fierce ride. And Haw Haw slunk behind the broad form of Mac Strann when the latter strode into the hotel. Then the two started for the room in which, they were told, lay Jerry Strann. "There it is," whispered Haw Haw as they reached the head of the stairs. "The door's open. If he was dead, the door would be closed, most like." They stood in the hall and looked in upon a strange picture. For flat in the bed lay Jerry Strann, his face very white and oddly thin, and over him leaned the man who had shot him down. They heard Dan Barry's soft, gentle voice query, "How are you feeling now, partner?" He leaned close beside the other, his fingers upon the wrist of Jerry.
"A pile better," muttered Jerry Strann. "Seems like I got a more fighting chance to pull through now."
"Just you keep lying here quiet," advised Dan Barry, "and don't stir around none. Don't start no worrying. You're going to live long as you don't lose no more blood. Keep your thoughts quiet. There ain't no cause for you to do nothing, but just keep your eyes closed and breathe, and think of yellow sunshine and green grass in the spring, and the wind lazing the clouds along across the sky. That's all you got to think about. Just keep quiet, partner.
It's easy to do it now you're with me. Seems like there's a pile of strength running into me from the tips of your fingers, my friend. And I was some fool to start that fight with you, Barry. Just forget all that, murmured the other, and keep your voice down. I forgot it, you forget it. It ain't never happened. What's it mean? Frowned Mac Strann, whispering to Haw-Haw. The eyes of the latter glittered like beads.
That's him that shot Jerry, said Haw-Haw. Him.
Hell, snarled Mac Strann, and went through the door. At the first sound of his heavy footfall, the head of Barry raised and turned in a light, swift movement. The next instant he was on his feet. A moment before, his face had been as gentle as that of a mother leaning over a sick child. But one glimpse of the threat in the contorted brows of Mac Strann
set a gleam in his own eyes,
an answer as distinct as the click of metal against metal. Not a word had been said, but Jerry, who had lain with his eyes closed, seemed to sense a change in the atmosphere of peace which had enwrapped him the moment before. His eyes flashed open, and he saw his burly brother.
But Mac Strann had no eye for any saving Dan Barry.
Are you the creepin', sneakin' snake that done this? You got me figured right, answered Dan coldly. Then by God, began the roaring voice of Mac. But Jerry Strann stirred wildly on the bed.
Mac, he called. Mac.
His voice went suddenly, horribly thick, a bubbling, liquid sound. For God's sakes, Mac. He had reared himself up on one elbow, his arm stretched out to his brother, and a foam of crimson stood on his lips. Mac, don't pull no gun. It was me that was in wrong. And then he fell back in the bed and into the arms of Mac, who was beside him, moaning. Buck up, Jerry. Talk to me, boy.
Mac, you finished the job, came the husky whisper.
Mac Strann raised his head and his terrible eyes fixed upon Dan Barry, and there was no pity in the face of the other. The first threat had wiped every vestige of human tenderness out of his eyes, and now, with something like a sneer on his lips,
and with a glimmer of yellow light in his eyes, he was backing towards the door, and noiselessly as a shadow, he slipped out and was gone. End of chapter 11.
Chapter 12 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 12. Finesse. A man talks because he's drunk or lonesome. A girl talks because that's her way of taking exercise. This was a maxim of Buck Daniels, and Buck Daniels knew a great deal about women, as many a schoolmarm and many a rancher's daughter of the mountain desert could testify. Also, Buck Daniels said of women, "It ain't what you say to 'em so much as the tune you put it to." Now he sat this day in O'Brien's hotel dining room. It was the lazy and idle hour between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, and since the men of the mountain desert eat promptly at 6, 12, and 6, there was not a soul in the room when he entered. Nor was there a hint of eating utensils on the tables. Nevertheless, Buck Daniels was not dismayed. He selected a corner table by instinct and smote upon the surface with the flat of his hand. It made a report like the spat of a .45. Heavy footsteps approached, a door flung open, and a cross-eyed slattern stood in the opening. At the sight of Buck Daniels sitting with his hands on his hips and his sombrero pushed back to a good-natured distance on his head, the lady puffed with rage. "What in the hell do you think this is?" bellowed this gentle creature, and the tone echoed heavily back from all four walls. "You're 3 hours late, and you get no chuck here. On your way, stranger." Buck Daniels elevated himself slowly from the chair and stood at his full height. With a motion fully as deliberate, he removed his sombrero and bowed to such a depth that the brim of the hat brushed the floor. "Lady," he said humbly, "I was thinking that some gent run this here eatin' place, which, if you'll excuse me half a minute, I'll ramble outside and sluice off some of the dust. If I'd known you was here, I wouldn't have thought of coming in here like this." The lady,
with the defective eyes, glared fiercely at him. Her judgment wavered two ways. Her first inclination was to hold that the fellow was jibing at her covertly, and she followed her original impulse far enough to clasp a neighboring sugar bowl in a large, capable hand. A second and more merciful thought entered her brain and stole slowly through it, like a faint echo in a great cave. "You don't have to make yourself pretty to talk to me," she said thoughtfully. "But if you're here for chow, you're too late."
"Ma'am," said Buck Daniels instantly, "when I come in here, I was hungry enough to eat nails. But I'll forget about Chuck if you'll sit down and chin with me a while."
The large hand of the cross-eyed lady stole out once more and rested upon the sugar bowl. "Do you mind saying that over again?" she queried.
"Lonesomeness is worse than hunger," said Buck Daniels, and he met her gaze steadily with his black eyes.
The hand released the sugar bowl once more. Something resembling color stole into the brown cheeks of the maiden. She said relentingly, "Maybe you've been off by yourself mining, stranger." Buck Daniels drew a long breath.
"Mines," he said, and then laughed bitterly. "If that was all I've been doing," he began darkly, and then stopped. The waitress started. "Maybe this here is my last chance to get Chuck for days and days. Well, let it go. If I stayed here with you, I'd be talking too much."
He turned slowly towards the door. His step was very slow indeed.
"Wait a minute," called the maiden. "There ain't any call for that play. If you're in wrong somewhere, well, stranger, just take that chair, and I'll have some ham in front of you inside of a minute."
She slammed through the door before Buck turned, and he sat down, smiling pleasantly to himself. Half of a mirror decorated the wall beside his table, and into this Buck peered. His black locks were sadly disarrayed, and he combed them into some semblance of order with his fingers. He had hardly finished this task when the door was kicked open with such force that it whacked against the wall, and the waitress appeared with an armful of steaming food. Before Buck's widening eyes, she swiftly set forth an array of bread, butter in chunks, crisp French-fried potatoes, a large slab of ham on one plate, and several fried eggs on another. And above all, there was a mighty pewter cup of coffee, blacker than the heart of night. Yearning seized upon Buck Daniels, but policy was stronger than hunger in his subtle mind. He rose again. He drew forth the chair opposite his own.
"Ma'am," said Buck Daniels,
"ain't you going to favor me by sitting down?" The lady blinked her unfocused eyes.
"Ain't I what?" she was finally able to ask.
"I know," said Buck Daniels swiftly, "that you're terrible busy, which you ain't got time to waste on a stranger like me." She turned upon Buck those uncertain and wistful eyes. It was a generous face. Mouth, cheekbones, and jaw were of vast proportions, while the forehead, eyes, and nose were as remarkably diminutive. Her glance lowered to the floor. She shrugged her wide shoulders and began to wipe the vestiges of dishwater from her freckled hands.
"You men are terrible foolish," she said. "There ain't no telling what you mean by what you say."
And she sank slowly into the chair. It gave voice in sharp protest at her weight. Buck Daniels retreated to the opposite side of the table and took his place.
"Ma'am," he began, "don't I look honest?"
So saying, he slid half a dozen eggs and a section of bacon from the platter to his plate.
"I dunno," said the maiden, with one eye upon him and the other plunging into the future. "There ain't no trustin' men. Take 'em by the lot, and they're awful forgetful."
"If you knowed me better," said Buck sadly, disposing of a slab of bread spread thick with the pale butter, and following this with a pile of fried potatoes astutely balanced on his knife, "if you knowed me better, ma'am, you wouldn't have no suspicions."
"What might it be that you've been doing?" asked the girl.
Buck Daniels paused in his attack on the food and stared at her. He quoted deftly from a magazine which had once fallen in his way.
"Some day, maybe I can tell you. There's something about your eyes that tells me you'd understand."
At the mention of her eyes, the waitress blinked and stiffened in her chair.
while a huge red fist balled itself in readiness for action. But the expression of Buck Daniels was as blandly open as the smile of infancy. The lady relaxed, and an unmistakable blush tinged even her nose with color. "It ain't after my nature to be asking questions," she announced. "You don't have to tell me no more'n you want to." "Thanks," said Buck instantly. "I knew you was that kind. It ain't hard," he went on smoothly, "to tell a lady when you see one. I can tell you this much to start with. I'm looking for a quiet town where I can settle down permanent. And, as far as I can see, Brownsville looks sort of quiet to me." So saying, he disposed of the rest of his food by an act akin to legerdemain, and then fastened a keen eye upon the lady. She was in the midst of a struggle of some sort, but she could not keep the truth from her tongue. "Take it by and large," she said at length, "Brownsville is as peaceable as most, but just now, stranger, it's all set for a big bust." She turned heavily in her chair and glanced about the room. Then she faced Daniels once more and cupped her hands about her mouth. "Stranger," she said in a stage whisper, "Mac Strann is in town." The eyes of Buck Daniels wondered. "Don't you know him?" she asked. "Nope." "Never heard of him?" "Nope." "Well," sighed the waitress, "you've had some luck in your life. Take a cross between a bulldog and a mustang and a mountain lion. That's Mac Strann. He's in town, and he's here for killing." "You don't say, ma'am. And why don't they lock him up?" "Because he ain't done nothing yet to be locked up about. That's the way with him. And when he does a thing, he always makes the man he's after pull his gun first. Smart? I'll say he's just like an Indian, that Mac Strann." "But who's he after?" "The fellow that plugged his brother, Jerry." "Kind of looks like he had a reason for killing, then." "Nope. Jerry had it coming to him. He was always raising trouble, Jerry was. And this time he pulled his gun first. Everybody seen him." "He run into a gunman?" "Gunman?" she laughed heartily. "Partner, if it wasn't for something funny about his eyes, I wouldn't be no more afraid of that gunman than I am of a tabby cat. And me, a weak woman. The quietest looking sort that ever come to Brownsville. But there's something queer about him. He knows that Mac Strann is here in town. He knows that Mac Strann is waiting for Jerry to die. He knows that when Jerry dies, Mac will be out for a killing. And this here stranger is just sitting around and waiting to be killed. Can you beat that?" Buck Daniels had grown strangely excited. "What did you say there was about his eyes?" he asked sharply. She grew suddenly suspicious. "Do you know him?" "No, but you was talking about his eyes." "I don't know what it is. I ain't the only one that's seen it. There ain't no word you can put to it. It's just there, that's all." The voice of Buck Daniels fell to a whisper. "It's sort of fire," he suggested. "Ain't it a kind of light behind his eyes?" But the waitress stared at him in amazement. "Fire," she gasped. "A light behind his eyes? My friend, are you trying to string me? What's his name?"
"I don't know."
"Ma'am," said Daniels, rising hastily, "here's $1 if you'll take me to him." "You don't need no guide," she replied. "Listen to that, will you?" And as he hearkened obediently, Buck Daniels heard a strain of whistling, needle sharp with distance.
"That's him," nodded the woman. "He's always going about whistling to himself. Kind of a nut he is."
"It's him," cried Buck Daniels. "It's him." And with this ungrammatical burst of joy, he bolted from the room. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of The Night Horseman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Night Horseman by Max Brand. Chapter 13. The Three. The whistling came from behind the hotel, and although it ended as soon as he reached the veranda of the building, Buck Daniels hurried to the rear of the place. There were the long, low sheds of the barn, and behind these, he knew, must be the corrals. He raced around the corner of the shed, and there came to a halt, for he saw a thing that turned his blood to ice.
One of those rare rains of the mountain desert had recently fallen, and the corrals behind the barn were carpeted with a short, thick grass. In the small corral nearest him, he beheld, rolling on that carpet of grass, a great wolf, or a dog as large and as rough-coated as a wolf, and a man, and they were engaged in a desperate and silent struggle for mastery. Their movements were so lightning fast that Buck Daniels could not make out distinct forms from the tangle. But he saw the great white teeth of the wolf flash in the sun one instant, and the next the man had whirled on top. It was Dan and Bart at play. No outcry from Dan, no growl from the wolf. Buck felt the old chill which never left him when he saw the fierce game of the wolf and the wolf man. All this passed in the twinkling of an eye, and then Dan, by prodigious effort, had thrown the great beast away from him, so that Bart fell upon its back. Dan leaped with outstretched arms upon the fallen animal, and buried his clutching hands in the throat of the beast. Yet still, there was a thrill to add to these, for now a black horse appeared in the picture, a miracle of slender, shimmering grace, and he rushed with flattened ears upon the two twisting, writhing, prostrate figures. His teeth were bared. He was more like a prodigious dog than a horse, and those teeth closed on the back of the man's neck, or did they merely pinch his shirt? And then Dan was dragged bodily away from the wolf, and thrown through the air by a flirt of the stallion's head. Horrible! Buck Daniels shuddered, and then he grinned shamefacedly in apology to himself. "The three of 'em," he grunted, and stepped closer to the fence to watch. The instant the man was torn away by the intercession of the horse, the wolf regained its feet and rushed upon him. But Dan had landed from his fall upon his feet with cat-like agility, and now he dodged the rush of the wolf and the arrowy spring of the creature, and sprang in his turn towards the stallion. The black met his attack by rearing, his ears flattened, his teeth bared, his eyes terrible to behold. As the man raced close, the stallion struck with lightning hoofs, but the blow failed of its mark by the breadth of a hair, and the assailant, swerving like a will-o'-the-wisp, darted to the side of the animal and leaped upon its back. At the same instant, the wolf left the ground with terribly gaping mouth in a spring for the rider. But Dan flattened himself along the shining back of his mount, and the wolf catapulted harmlessly past. After this failure, the wolf dog seemed to desire no further active part in the struggle, but took up a position to one side, and there, with lolling tongue and red-stained eyes, watched the battle continue. The stallion, to be sure, kept up the conflict with a wholehearted energy. Never had Buck Daniels, in a long and varied career, seen such wild pitching. The black leaped here and there, doubling about with the sinuous speed of a snake, springing high into the air one instant and landing the next on stiff legs, dropping to the ground the next second and rolling to crush the rider, up again like a leaf jerked up by a gale of wind. And so fierce the struggle continued, with the wild rider slapping the neck of the horse as if he would encourage it to more terrible efforts, and drumming its round barrel with vindictive heels. His hair blew black, his face flushed, and in his eyes there was the joy of the sailor, long land-bound, who climbs at last the tallest mast and feels it pitch beneath him and catches the sharp tang of the traveled wind. The struggle ceased as if in obedience to an inaudible command. From the full frenzy of motion, horse and man were suddenly moveless. Then Dan slipped from his seat and stood before his mount. At once the ears of the stallion, which had been flat back, pricked sharply forward. The eyes of the animal grew luminous and soft as the eyes of a woman, and he dropped the black velvet of his muzzle beneath the master's chin. As for Dan Barry, he rewarded this outburst of affection with no touch of his hand, but his lips moved,
and he seemed to be whispering a secret to his horse. The wolf, in the meantime, had viewed this scene with growing unrest, and now it trotted up and placed itself at the side of the man. Receiving no attention in this position, it caught the arm of the man between its great fangs and drew his hands down. The stallion, angered by this interruption, raised a delicate forefoot to strike and was received with a terrific snarl, the first sound of the entire scene. "Bart," said the man, and his voice was not raised or harsh, but came as softly as running water. "If you ain't going to be a gentleman, I got to teach you manners. Get up on Satan's back and lie down till I tell you to get off." The wolf received this command with a snarl even more blood-curdling than before, but he obeyed, slinking sideways a reluctant pace or two, and then springing to the back of the stallion with a single bound. There he crouched, still snarling softly, until his master raised a significant forefinger. At that, he lowered his head and maintained a fiercely observant silence. "Dan," called Buck Daniels. "The other world." "Speaking of pets," observed Buck Daniels, "I heard tell once about a gent that had a tame lion. Which you got the outbeatingest pair I ever see, Dan. Gentle, ain't they? Like a stampede of cows." But Barry left this remark unanswered. He ran to the tall fence, placed his hand on the top rail, and vaulted lightly over it. Then he clasped the hand of the larger man, and his face lighted. "Buck," he said, "I've been sort of lonesome. It feels pretty good to see you again." "Oh, man," answered Buck Daniels. "Speaking of being lonesome," he checked himself. "How about stepping inside and having a talk?" The other started forward agreeably, but stopped almost at once. "Heel," he called, without turning his head. Black Bart left the back of the stallion in a long bound that carried him halfway to the fence. His next leap brought him over the rail and beside his master. Buck Daniels moved back a step involuntarily. "Bart," he said, "do you know me?" He stretched out his hand and was received with a sudden baring of the fangs. "Nice dog," said Buck sarcastically. "Regular house pet, ain't he?" The other apparently missed the entire point of this remark. He said in his gentle, serious way, "He used to be real wild, Buck. But now he don't mind people. He let the cook feed him a chunk of meat the other day. And you remember, he don't usually touch stuff that other men have handled." "Yep," grunted Buck. "Sure is disgusting to have a dog as tame as that. I bet he ain't killed another dog for a whole day, maybe." And still Barry saw no irony in this. He answered as gravely as before. "No, it was the day before yesterday. Somebody come to town and got drunk. He had two dogs and sicked them on Bart." Buck Daniels controlled an incipient shudder. "Both dead?" "I was inside the house," said Dan sadly, "and it took me a couple of seconds to get outside. Of course, by that time, Bart had cut their throats." "Of course. Didn't a drunk guy try to pop Bart?" "Yes, he got out his gun. But Mr. O'Brien, the bartender, persuaded him out of it. I was glad there wasn't no trouble." "My God," exclaimed Buck Daniels. And then, "Well, let's go inside. We'll take your man-eater dog along if you want to." A shadow came into the eyes of Barry. "Can't we just talk out here? What's the matter with finding some chairs?" "Because I don't like to get inside walls. You know how four walls seem like so many pairs of eyes standing round you." "No," said Buck bluntly. "I don't know nothing of the kind. What do you mean?" "I dunno," answered Barry, depressed. "It just seems that way. Ain't you noticed how sort of close it is in a house? Hard to breathe? Like you had on a shirt too small for you." "We'll stay out here then." The other nodded, smiled, and made a gesture to the dog behind him. Black Bart crouched on the ground, and Dan Barry sat down cross-legged, his shoulders leaning against the shaggy pelt of Bart. Daniels followed the example with less grace. He was thinking very hard and fast, and he rolled a Durham cigarette to fill the interlude.
"I suppose you're busting to find out the news about the folks," he said dryly at last. The other sat with his hands loosely clasped in his lap. His wide eyes looked far away, and there was about his lips that looseness, that lack of compression, which one sees so often in children. He might have sat in that posture for the statue of thoughtlessness. "What folks?" he asked at last. Buck Daniels had lighted a match, but now he sat staring blank until the match burned down to his fingers. With an oath, he tossed the remnant away and lighted another. He had drawn down several long breaths of smoke to the bottom of his lungs before he could speak again. "Some people you used to know. I suppose you've forgotten all about them, eh?" His eyes narrowed. There was a spark of something akin to dread in them. "Kate Cumberland?" he queried. A light came in the face of Dan Barry. "Kate Cumberland?" he repeated. "How is she, Buck? Lately, I've been thinking about her every day." A trembling took the body and the voice of Daniels. His errand, after all, might meet some success. "Kate?" he repeated. "Oh, aye, she's well enough. But Joe Cumberland ain't." "No." "He's dying, Dan." And Dan replied calmly, "He's kind of old, I suppose." "Old?" said Buck, with a sort of horror. "Yes, he's old right enough. Do you know why he's dying? It's because you went away the way you done, Dan. That's what's killing him." Something of thought came into the face of Barry. "Maybe I understand," he said slowly. "If I was to lose Satan or Bart..." Here the great dog whined at the mention of his name, and Barry dropped the slender hand across the scarred forehead of his servant. "If I was to lose him, I'd sort of mourn for him, maybe." Buck Daniels set his teeth. "I don't suppose it seems possible," he said, "that a man could miss another man the way you could miss your dog, eh? But it is. Joe Cumberland is dying for you, Dan, as sure as you've put a bullet in his bowels." The other hesitated, and then frowned, and made a gesture of vague dismissal. "Don't you figure on doing nothing about it?" asked Buck softly. "What could I do?" "My God Almighty, ain't you got no human feelings?" "I don't know what you mean," said the soft voice. "This. Can't you get on your hoss and ride back with me to Cumberland Ranch? Stay with the old man till he gets back on his feet. Ain't that easy to do? Is your time so damn valuable you can't spare a few days for that?" "But I am going back," answered Dan in a rather hurt voice. "There ain't no need for cussing me, Buck. I've been thinking of Kate every day almost." "Since when?" "I don't know." Dan stirred uneasily. He looked up and far above Buck, following the direction of Dan's eyes, and saw a pattern of wild geese. "I've been sort of drifting north toward the Cumberland Ranch and Kate," went on Dan. He sighed. "I've been thinking of her eyes, which is blue, Buck, and her hair and the soft sound of her voice. They've been hanging in my ears, staying behind my eyes lately, and I've been drifting up that way, steady." "Why, man," cried Buck, "what's there to keep you here? Jump on your horse and we'll head north in 10 minutes. "I will," said Dan, full as eagerly. "We'll start full speed." "Come on, then." "Wait a minute," said Dan, his voice growing suddenly cold. "I've been forgetting something." Buck Daniels turned and found his companion strangely changed. There was a set expression of coldness about his face and a chill glitter in his eyes. "I got to wait here for something." "What's that?" "There's a man in town that may want to see me." "Mac Strann? I've heard about him. Dan, are you going to let Joe Cumberland die because you want to stay here and fight it out with a dirty cutthroat?" "I don't want to fight," protested Barry. "No, there ain't nothing I like less than fighting." Buck Daniels cursed softly and continuously to himself. "Dan," he said, "can you sit there and lie to me like that? Ain't I seen you in action? Don't I remember the way you trailed Jim Silent? Don't I remember how we all got down and prayed you'd keep away from Jim? Don't I remember how you threw everything to hell so you could get your hands on Jim? My God Almighty, man, didn't I see your face when you had your fingers in Silent's throat?"
An expression of unutterable revulsion rippled over the face of Dan Barry. "Stop," he commanded softly, and raised his slender hand. "Don't keep on talking about it. It makes me sick all through. Oh, Buck, there's a tingle in the tips of my fingers still from the time I had him in his throat. And it makes me feel unclean, the sort of uncleanness that won't wash out with no kind of soap and water. Buck, I'd most rather die myself than fight a man." A vast amazement overspread the countenance of Buck Daniels as he listened to this outburst. It was as if he had heard a healthy man proclaim that he had no desire for bread and meat. Something rose to his lips, but he swallowed it. "Then it looks kind of simple to me," he said. "You hate fighting? This gent Mac Strann likes it. He lives on it. He don't do nothing but wake from day to day, hungering for a scrap. What's that out? Just this. You hop on your horse and ride out with me. Young Jerry Strann kicks out. Mac Strann starts looking for you. He hears that you've beat it. He goes off and forgets about you. Ain't that simple?" The old uneasiness returned to the far-seeing eyes of Dan Barry. "I don't know," he said. "Maybe." Then he paused again. "Have you got anything to say again it?" urged Buck, arguing desperately. "I don't know," repeated Barry, confused. "Except that I keep thinking what a terrible disappointment it will be to this Mac Strann when his brother dies and I ain't around." Buck Daniels stared, blinked, and then burst into unmelodious laughter. Satan trotted across the corral and raised his head above the fence, whinnying softly. Barry turned his head and smiled up to the horse. Then he said, "Seems like if Jerry Strann dies, I owe somebody something." "Who?" "Mac Strann, I reckon. I sort of got to stay and give him his chance." "I hope to God," burst out Daniel, smashing his hands together, "that Mac Strann beats you to a pulp. That's what I hope." The eyes of Dan Barry widened. "Why do you hope that?" he asked gently. It brought Daniels again to speechlessness. "Is it possible?" he growled to himself. "Are you a human being, and yet you think more of your horse and your damn wolf dog than you do of the life of a man? Dan, I'm asking you straight, is that a square thing to do?" The fragile hands went out to him, palm up. "Don't you see, Buck? I don't want to be this way. I just can't help it." "Then the Lord help poor old Joe Cumberland, him that took you in out of the desert, him that raised you from the time you was a kid, him that nursed you like you was his own baby, him that loved you more'n he loved Kate, him that's lying back there now with fire in his eyes, waiting, waiting, waiting for you to come back. Dan, if you was to see him, you'd go down on your knees and ask him to forgive you." "I suppose I would," murmured Barry thoughtfully. "Dan, you're going with me. I don't somehow think it's my time for moving, Buck. Is that all you got to say to me?" "I guess maybe it is, Buck. If I was to beg you to come for old time's sake, and all we've been through together, you and me, wouldn't it make no difference to you?" The large, gentle eyes focused far beyond Buck Daniels, somewhere on a point in the pale, hazy blue of the spring sky. "I'm kind of tired of talking, Buck," he said at length. And Buck Daniels rose and walked slowly away, with his head fallen. Behind him, the stallion neighed suddenly and loud, and it was so much like a blast of defiant triumph that Buck whirled and shook his clenched fist at Satan. End of chapter 13.